The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Centre Parks. Families that go here, grow here.
It's 9:31 and our guest this morning joining us live in studio as he cracks open another bottle of water is the great Joseph O'Connor. Good morning, Joseph, and welcome.
Thank you very much, Ryan. It's lovely to see you again. Lovely to start this January morning with the Rolling Stones and Lady Gregory, two of my great.
So we're ticking a lot of boxes for you, this morning. We haven't even said hello.
It was lovely.
Okay, well, it's always good to see you. You're Joseph O'Connor in your books. Are you Joe to anyone?
Joe to pretty much everyone, yeah. So it's my father calls me Joe, and my lovely stepmother calls me Joseph. And when I was 21, my dad said he wanted me to call him Sean from now on, which I do. And I think my two kids might now want to start calling me Joe. And I will report further on that. But
yes.
But yeah, Joe, for this.
I always thought it was peculiar when I was a kid when people referred to their parents by their first names. I was like, I was discombobulated socially by it. I just thought it was a very peculiar thing to do.
Yeah, well, mine have referred to me by other terms too over the years.
We were discussing, I have your book, I read it before Christmas. Congratulations, we've got so much to talk about. My father's house. In fact, I was in a bookshop yesterday and a woman came in. She goes, hello, and I said, hello. And I said, what are you going for today? And she said, oh, Joseph O'Connor's new book. And she was looking around for it. And I picked it off the shelf. Oh. I said, there you are.
God, yeah. God bless you, Ryan.
We'll
hand sell every copy if we need to.
Door to door, guerrilla sales. But we were talking about reading. And I, as you can see, I have these little post-its that I keep by my bed that I sometimes when I'm going to be interviewing the author, I'll pick out bits that I like. And you said to me just a second ago that you read with a pen in your hand.
Yes, I do. And I'm a fierce underliner of books. And sometimes I come across a book in the house that I might have read 20 years ago or even when I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And I see things that I underlined when I was 17 or when I was 25 and I wonder why. And it's quite a revealing thing about somebody, I think, the bits that they would pick out in a book. I mean, I've often thought there's a short story or a novella or something based on looking into the books that somebody has read and their notes and their underlinings.
I love
you
that.
Know, it's quite revealing about the things that mean something to us as readers or meant something to us at the time. And then, of course, if you read the book now, you'd underline different things. I think it's the hallmark of a really great book is that it's capable of being reread. You know, I have my Desert Island books that I come back to every two or three years. It's like going on a pilgrimage to me. If I get tired of reading, I go back to Oscar and Lucinda by Peter Carey or Jazz by Toni Morrison or The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger, books that I've been reading for 20 or 30 years in some cases. And I always see something new in them. And I think that is the test. You know?
Yes, yes. I gave The Catcher in the Rye to my daughter on her 18th birthday just to explain what a phony is, just so you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've given it to a few young people over the years. And I mean, I think people's responses to it have changed because the whole business of being a teenager has changed. And the wonderful, irreverent, cheeky character that is Holden Caulfield, the narrator of The Catcher in the Rye, when you read him when we were kids, I mean, he was explosive because nobody ever talked to grown-ups.
It's all changed now.
Like that. There's a touch of kind of punk rock about Holden Caulfield. And I think it has changed, and young people quite rightly have a better sense of themselves and their rights, and they're more articulate and all of that. So I'm not sure that The Catcher still has the appeal to younger people that it had to me. But in my that's the book that made me want to be a writer.
Is it really?
Yes, it is. I mean, I grew up in a home where there were books and I always loved reading. But I could probably date this, Ryan, if I thought about it carefully enough. But on a particular day when I was in fifth year in school, I remember turning the last page of The Catcher in the Rye and saying, I would like to do that with my life. You know, it had a profound effect on me. And I sometimes think that every book I've ever written since, it to some extent, has been an attempt to write something as powerful and beautiful and funny and moving as The Catcher in the Rye. And I think a lot of writers would have a similar story. That was the one that made all the difference to me.
The writing, just to go back a step to your to what you do with the book, with the writing on it. You know, purists are going, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Desecrating. But actually, you've described it beautifully. I was kind of being judgmental for a moment. And the way you describe it and how you go back and underline it differently as you're older, it kind of makes sense in it.
No, I think it's touching that people do have a reverence for books. Yeah. I mean, I remember, like, my grandparents did not even like a book to be dog-eared. You know, Salman Rushdie, I remember an interview with him once, he said that in the home he grew up in, if a book fell on the floor, his father would pick up the book and kiss it before putting it back in the shelf.
Like, kiss it better.
Yeah,
like it.
But to me, it's part of my relationship with them. It gets a bit physical, right?
Yeah,
I write on the books, and then I have a little record when I look back later of what I was thinking and feeling at the time.
Yes.
And then sometimes, you know, if you're reading John McGahern or Anne Enright or Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you just see a sentence that's so beautiful that you underline that, James Joyce, just as a reminder of what's possible with the beautiful sentence. I mean, the beautiful sentence is a fantastic invention. There's nothing really that moves us as readers, and I think in a particular way as Irish people who read, than the sentence that is just made and crafted and it doesn't have a wasted word and the punctuation's in the right place. And we read that with the great joy of recognition and pleasure, and we go, God, look what this funny, brittle thing called the English language is capable of doing. So every writer should aspire towards that.
You've described what I think maybe Claire Keegan is doing pretty spectacularly at the moment.
Yeah.
Because it's such little short novellas, but very big, big stories and beautiful language.
Well, I think and have thought for a long time that Claire Keegan is a genius. I mean, what she's able to do with such sparseness. You know, there's never a wasted word.
That's it.
She doesn't really have metaphors and similes and lots of adjectives. She doesn't really describe things. She just incarnates them on the page. And it's a wonderful thing to be in the presence of writing that has that kind of authority.
You said, one of your books, I remember, just talking about lines that knock you out. You described self-deprecation, if I'm not mistaken, as being something along, paraphrasing, the greatest form of vanity.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting because I was using self-deprecation as a stock in trade for years on radio and TV, I look like this and I feel like this and what have you. And then when I read that, I went, oh gosh, you're right, because what you want then is for people to go, no, you're great, no, you look fab, no. And suddenly you're made, well, I kind of stopped doing it then, really.
Well, I'm sorry to have had
it was a great
profound effect. No, I mean, well, for example, in My Father's House, there's a lot of scenes set in the opera because it's set in Rome and the central character, Hugh O'Flaherty, is a big music fan and he loves going to the opera in Rome. And anyone who ever has knows that at the end when the diva comes out to bow, there's the spectacular round of applause and then there's the first curtain call and it's mild applause and then the third curtain call and it's a bit of a trickle of applause, but the diva's going to keep coming out, you know, and it's a way of kind of keeping you there to tell me how great I am.
That's what a diva does.
Yeah,
so
it's, I think modesty is sometimes a form of boasting.
When did you first come across the name Hugh O'Flaherty? Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty.
Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, yeah. Well, obviously I've been thinking about this, Ryan, and I don't have a definite answer. I have a feeling that it was in Listowel, County Kerry, where there is the world famous Writers' Week, and I've been going to that since I was a young fella, since before I ever published a book. You know, I've been going on and off to Listowel for 30 years now, and I love it, and you know, it's a wonderful Irish literary festival. And I think it was one night in the bar late at night of the Listowel Arms Hotel that somebody told me the story of Hugh O'Flaherty, who was born in Cork in 1898, brought up in Kerry, very much thought of himself as a Kerry person, and Kerry people are rightly very proud of him. He grew up in the 1920s. He was a young man, so the black and tans and all of that was going on, and in a particular way in that part of the country. Mm-hmm. He became a school teacher, and then in his later 20s, he became a Catholic priest. And he was a learned, scholarly fellow with a couple of PhDs, and he spoke five or six languages. And he went off to Rome, where he worked in the Curia, the Vatican civil service. So Hugh is in the Vatican in the late 1930s, as the Second World War breaks out. As people who've been to Rome will know, the Vatican is actually an independent state. It's one of the smallest countries in the world. It's about a sixth of a square mile, and there is a boundary around the Vatican. So the Nazis invaded many places in Europe, including Italy, closer and closer to Rome. They moved into Rome, conquered Rome in September of 1943, but they did not enter the Vatican. They, I won't say respected its neutrality, but I think they were afraid to enter the Vatican because of the response of Catholic people in Germany. So Hugh is based there, and he begins to put together a small group of friends who work as an escape line, helping allied prisoners who've escaped from the fascist prisoner of war camps in Italy to safety. So they hid many of them in the Vatican, and they smuggled many out. So he put himself in the way of immense danger doing this. He could have been killed at any point during the nine-month occupation of Rome. His priesthood would certainly not have saved him, because the Gestapo, as we know, murdered at least two Catholic priests during the occupation of Rome. He was warned to stop his work of aiding fugitives and escapees, not only by the Germans, but by the Irish government, which, as you know, was neutral during World War II. So they didn't want a pretext that would drag Ireland into the war.
The quote, if I cut across, tell that man, is that the quote, tell that man he will end up in a concentration camp if he's not careful, and it might do him some good.
Yeah, well,
where did that quote come from?
That's from an official document that anybody can see. It's in the Department of Foreign Affairs archive,
wow,
where they're becoming increasingly concerned about this troublesome priest who's going around Rome saving British soldiers and allied troops, having been told not to. And it's quite a chilling document for the Irish government to say to an Irish citizen, you're going to end up in a concentration camp, and maybe it would do you some good.
Good enough for you, yeah.
Then there was the attitude of the Vatican hierarchy, which is also telling him to stop, because they want the physical and cultural and artistic legacy of the Vatican to be preserved. They don't want the Nazi tanks rolling into St. Peter's Square and the swastika flying from the basilica, perhaps. And he must have argued with himself about it. There must have been moments when he wrestled with all of this himself, but he seems to have been one of those people whose moral compass was so strong that he just decided, I am going to act. And I have a sense of him saying, you know, today I could save three people. I could actually save the lives of three or four or 10 people. The escaped soldiers used to turn up in St. Peter's Square. He hid in the open. He was a big, tall man. He stood on the steps of the basilica. And word got around the prisoner of war camps, if you can just make your way into the Vatican, find this man, he will save you. So he could have been shot by a sniper. He could have been kidnapped by the Gestapo. He showed immense personal courage and bravery. So he's an unusual figure, because, as I say, he's quite scholarly. He's a very learned man, but he's kind of man of action. His family very graciously gave me access to his correspondence while I was preparing and researching, my father says. And there's kind of very touching things in it about he was an old school guy. I lived in South London for 7 years, and he was what they used to call in South London a stand-up guy. He was more George Raft than Bing Crosby. He loved boxing. He loved sport. He was a very devout man, but he as he's, somebody said about him once, was not the kind of priest who lived and died and ate and slept in the church. He loved social life.
Golf.
He liked music. He liked golf. And he very brilliantly put together this group of people, about seven or eight people, to help him in this effort of saving the fugitives. And the remarkable thing about them is they're not seven or eight Catholic priests. They're from very different faith perspectives and backgrounds. The women in this group were very, very important, including one amazing woman who fans of Irish music will know, Delia Murphy, Delia Kiernan, as she was known in Rome at the time, who had a career as a folk singer, a ballad singer in Ireland. She had made albums. I was chatting recently about her with John Kelly,
yes,
who said to me that Delia Murphy at the time really was like a pop star. She was 1940s Ireland, you know, answer to a pop star. She was in Rome because her husband was the Irish ambassador
Tom
Kiernan, who was very much involved in this
story. I was laughing at it going, oh, that's mad, because my brief foray into trying to write something was a Kennedy book, and it was the Shamrock ceremony, the bowl of Shamrock given to President Kennedy was given to him by Kiernan, Kieran. And in the research of that, I found that she was, his wife was a big star.
She was, yeah.
And, but also they were the crack. Like that was the, as a diplomat and a really interesting wife.
Yeah.
And people wanted to go to their parties.
Yeah. I think Tom Kiernan had a role in RTE as well. Now, forgive me for not knowing absolutely off the top of my head, but not that he was the director general, but a senior role in RTE
but she was
before he became a diplomat.
She's the figure in your book.
She's in Rome and she's kind of very likable, sociable woman who is Catholic but kind of skeptical, and she thinks being the wife of the Irish ambassador to Rome involves a lot of kind of standing around and being talked at by archbishops and, as she says, pretending to listen. And she feels a great empathy for the young Irish people in Rome who are entering religious life. There might be 500 young men and women in Rome who want to be priests and nuns. It's the Second World War. There's no food. It's very, very frightening. You know, there are air raids happening often.
Menace.
Planes the size of a London bus appear in the sky, raining down bombs. And she decides, well, all I have is you know, an embassy, and the embassy has a swimming pool, and I'm going to invite these young people around once a week and feed them and let them use the swimming pool. And her husband goes mad, saying, well, at least, the sexes must attend on different days. And she says, well, you know, you're no fun, but that's why I married you.
Yeah.
So a kind of irreverent, fascinating, very independent woman. So she becomes one of the helpers of Hugh O'Flaherty in the escape line. Another person is a British escape officer, Sam Derry, who's got like military knowledge and counter-surveillance training. There's the British ambassador who is, you know, an aristocratic person who is a friend of the Queen Mother, Sir Hugh Darcy Osborne. And then a character who really intrigues me called John May, who was his butler, and he was a Cockney. And every group of people who want to do good and be high-minded and save people and believe in human rights, they always need a guy like John May, because he's the guy. If you want a stolen German motorbike, if you want train tickets to Zurich,
stockings and a pan of some chocolate,
John May is the guy you go to. So it's a mixture of my version of characters based on real people, and then I have also invented fictional characters. So in that sense, a bit like the structure of my book Star of the Sea, which takes, you know, real events and real people as the starting point for a novel. So that's my father's house in four minutes.
I think in the few minutes that we've got, it's such a taster for it now that who would not want to pick it up? And you, in my father's house, there are many rooms, isn't that? That's the...
Yeah, it's a biblical quote from the sayings of Jesus. He says at one point, in my father's house are many rooms. And it just struck me as having a resonance for this story, because Hugh O'Flaherty and his band of activists hid people in attics and cellars and basements and outhouses and sculleries and hidden rooms the length and breadth of Rome. They may have saved 7,000 people's lives. There are certainly people alive today who are the children and the grandchildren of the many, many people who Hugh O'Flaherty saved through his courage. So yes, it struck me as a might be a nice line about Rome, that there are very many rooms, more than there appear to be, and Hugh O'Flaherty knows all of them.
Yes, and what I mean, it's movie. Obviously, The Scarlet and the Black was a film starring Gregory Peck, and you can see why they would want to make a movie of this. But you've brought it into a much more nuanced, if you like, look at characters. But I thought there was a strange mix of fun and menace, you know, because there's that kind of cat and mouse feel to it, but yet there was always the dark cloud of the hunt.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the things that strikes you when you look at the real story is how like a thriller it was, and I suppose I took one of my lighthouses when I was writing the book was the fact that Hugh liked the movies himself. So I was thinking about those classic kind of 1940s noir, Humphrey Bogart movies, and a lot of the book takes place underground. Yeah. Hugh has a great knowledge of the kind of the tunnels and catacombs of Rome. Yeah. We were in Rome at Christmas as a family, and we went on a tour of the Scavi, the excavations underneath St. Peter's. Yeah. One of the most remarkable places I've ever been. Tunnels that, until the 1940s, when they were discovered, nobody had been in for 1,000 years. Many people who've been to Rome would have been to the Trevi Fountain, but very few people know that immediately behind the Trevi Fountain, there's a hidden aqueduct. Yeah. Rome is a very interesting place in terms of its underground life. And Hugh, of course, knows all about that. So those were the colours I was kind of thinking of.
Yeah.
Black and white, noir. And there's a lot of music in the book, ranging from opera to jazz and sacred music, Palestrina, and all of that.
I've taken to, on occasion, when a book features music like yours do, I've taken to putting on the music you mention as I'm reading that passage in the book as a soundtrack.
When I was writing it.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
It really adds to it. It's quite an immersive experience for reading.
Well, I should say that one of the kind of ways of... that the escape line has of concealing its activities, they become convinced that the Gestapo have bugged every room in the Vatican and in wider Rome. So they masquerade as a choir.
Yeah.
They establish themselves as a little chamber choir of 8 people, and they meet 2 or 3 times a week for rehearsal. And as they're singing this wonderful music, and the bombs are raining down from on high, and the Nazis... stormtroopers might be at the end of the street, they're passing around notes to each other about who's going to escape this week, how we're going to do it, what the plan and the tactic is. So it begins as just a concealment, but then over the months and weeks of the occupation, it was a lovely thing to write about how even the people in the group who are not religious, the people who are atheist, the people who are communist, as they continue to sing this beautiful music, it starts to mean something to them, because it's just the act of singing and it's just the beauty of the music. So there's a lot in the book about the beauty and the texture of the cultural life of Rome.
But as every guilty-hearted author will know, I'm quoting your book here, there are afternoons when you are supposed to be writing, when all you can face is a cup of tea and a walk. A book rather gets its hands around your throat and shakes you until your fillings fall out. Some writers are skilled with words, but all of us are skilled with procrastination, and what I wanted was to postpone the inevitable. I just got a sense of...
confession. I was going to confession.
I felt I was reading your Leaving Cert nervousness journal before you started. Listen, so much love for you. Great listening to Joseph. You may like to know that we have an oral history recording compiled with Sister Noreen Dennehy, secretary to Hugh O'Flaherty at the Vatican during World War II. Good Lord. And we can send you the MP3 if you'd like.
I'd love that, yeah.
Lovely Morrison, Jane O'Keefe. Thank you, and Tralee from lifeandlore.com. That's fascinating. Joseph, would you consider doing the odd radio diary like the old days? They were great. Neil in Ring's End wants to know.
Who knows? I'd love to. I'm going to write a Sunday miscellany soon about Father Hugh. So I'm looking forward to that.
That would be great. What's Joe's opinion on why a famous book like Catcher in the Rye has never been turned into a Hollywood movie?
Well,
these are quick fire. Sorry.
Yeah, there is a movie of Catcher in the Rye, but it's better as a book.
Okay. I recently went to Kenny's in Galway where Joe was reading. Most entertaining. I'd like to ask, what's his favourite genre to read? Do you have one?
I read a lot of poetry because I don't really write poetry myself. I don't read fiction when I'm writing a novel. So Paul Muldoon's latest book of poetry, which is called Howdy Skelp, is fabulous. My colleague at UL, Emily Cullen, I love her poetry. I love the work of my UL colleague, Donal Ryan. Yeah. But mainly when I'm writing fiction, I'm reading poetry.
Poetry helps. Somebody else was on about Shadowlands and saying... Shadowplay. Read it twice and looking forward to this, and then gives a big quote from Brian McDevitt in Glenties: in every being who lives, there is a second self very little known to anyone. And that's the quote from that. I gave a copy of that to Jamie Lee Curtis as a present off-air.
She's now
an Oscar nominee. but I just thought it was a nice book for her.
I always like to
give an Irish author's book, and you're just in my favourites gang, if you will. You're going to be reading from My Father's House in conversation with Flor McCarthy at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary on Wednesday, the 1st of February. Get tickets for that fast, though. That's at 8 o'clock, and you'll have music from the Veritas Chamber Choir of St. Columbus College. So paviliontheatre.ie for all those details. Yeah. What a beautiful book, another addition to my shelf that I'm very proud to have. And privilege of the job to be able to talk to you this morning, Joe. Thanks so much for your time.
It's lovely to have been with you, Ryan. Thanks very much.
As always, it's 5 to 10.